So, Paul, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We love having ex-players, ex-managers, journalists, and authors as well. And you had a fourth author, I think, we've had on the podcast. So welcome. So first of all, the book is now in print, or at least the initial print run for subscribers is available. That must be some feeling for you to sort of have it there, because I know there's been a lot of time you've spent putting into these books, and it must be a great feeling to get that back from the publishers and finally see it in print.
First thing, Danny, thanks for having me on. Your podcasts have been like a who's who of York City. This is more probably a who's he of York City, I think, really. In terms of the book, yeah, it's been a long journey, actually. When I think back, I never intended to write a book. I stress that. This book has been really, really troublesome in terms of timelines, because obviously City moved in 2021 to the new stadium, and then it was, well, I'll cover the first season at the new stadium. And then, of course, Bootham Crescent started to, its fate became defined in stone what would happen. And then, of course, it started to be redeveloped. And then there was the final activities at the ground and the sale of the items. So it's always had mission drift, a lot of mission drift. And, of course, Jason McGill left. So that was another, you know, key part of the Bootham Crescent story. And then, of course, we've had everything since then. So, and of course, last year, or last season, I should say, we had the promotion push, and I was absolutely convinced we would go up, absolutely convinced, especially after we won at Eastleigh the way we did. So I thought it would probably be great to have a happy ending. Everyone likes a happy ending, Dan, I found to my cost. So to finally get the book out there is wonderful in one respect, but it's also a little bit of a relief in another, because this book has been bubbling for the last 3 or 4 years in my mind, and it's just glad, I'm just glad it's out there now.
And we've known each other a few years now, haven't we? You've sponsored some of the podcast episodes in the past. We shared a brilliant 8-hour round trip to Southend on the opening day of last season.
Yeah, we did, yeah, last year, yeah.
As well as other conversations, you know, in the past few years. But sort of doing my research for this interview, there's so much I didn't know about you already, which is incredible, really.
Oh, dear.
For example, you've never actually lived in York. I think your first game you actually went to was a Middlesbrough game. So talk us through how you actually ended up supporting York City in the first place.
Right. So I was born in Fulford, Dan. I want to put that out there. So I guess you could say I was a Fulford lad. So as a kid, I was just football daft. You know, back in the day, everybody was football for 9 months a year and cricket for 3 months a year. The first football memory I have is Charlie George. Those of a certain vintage will remember Charlie George scoring a goal, winning goal in the FA Cup final in 1971 and out. But the first game I actually went to was Middlesbrough against West Bromwich Albion in 1973 at Ayrton Park. That was the very first game, but the first game at City was on Good Friday 1974 against Huddersfield. I went and City won 2-1, and it just felt right. It just felt a really good fit for a lad like me, you know, a bit wet behind the ears, 10-year-old, lived in a little market town. And there was a proper crowd there. There was about 10,000 there. I was in the pop stand on the white railings, right on the halfway line. Can't remember anything at all about the game, but I can remember how it made me feel, you know. And it had these whopping great floodlights, and it had a programme shop, and, you know, there was just this little hint of menace in air which football had in the 70s and 80s. And City won. They were a winning team. And everybody at school followed Middlesbrough or followed Leeds or followed Liverpool or Man United or whatever. And I thought, this is right for me. And then I went to quite a few games in the second division era, you know, 74, 75, 75, 76. And I was absolutely hooked after that. And so probably from age of 10, really, age of 11, I've been York City daft. The ironic thing I look back on is it was a warning even then back in history that life wouldn't be straightforward being a York fan, because but the very next day, it was Good Friday, the very next day they were at home again to Shrewsbury Town. Shrewsbury were bottom at league. City was something like second or third. And you might guess Shrewsbury won 1-0. So there was a big warning there for me that I was backing the wrong horse if I wanted, you know, instant success. But, you know, that's not what it's about, is it really?
No, and I think you kind of learn to appreciate the success, don't you, when it comes, because
you're not getting it
time and time again. So, I mean, there's going to football and supporting the team, but clearly, as we all know, kind of you're going to become a historian. So you must have had an early interest in sort of stats and newspaper articles and stuff like that. I mean, I remember Southend away, you recited every opening day fixture and result for every season that you'd been to. And I was like absolutely blown away that you were able to do that. And I'm sure if I'd have pushed you, you'd have been able to tell me who scored and what minutes there were and stuff like that. So when did that all sort of start? When did you start becoming interested in sort of facts and stats and all that sort of stuff?
I go back to my childhood a little bit, because I was bought the Purnell's Encyclopedia of Football when I was about 7 or 8, and it was just fantastic. There was just so many stats and numbers in there, and Chelsea had 82,905, their record home attendance, and yet and there's dwarfed Liverpool's home attendance. I mean, I couldn't quite get my head around that at the time, and it was just wonderful. I lost myself in all the history of the game. Then I got into the FA Cup finals, you know, going back to 1872. I just thought it was wonderful. And of course, football is, you know, 92 league clubs, and there's 92 grounds, 92 colours, 92 programmes. It was just a whole world of wonder, association football. And they played football on like cabbage patches back in the day. If you ever watch anything, you know, or the old soccer in the 70s and the big match and that. So I very quickly got into the stats, and I very quickly got into the memorabilia side as well. And those two things tend to go hand in hand. I also remember getting the Sunday newspaper when it came into the household, and when I finally got hold of it, I just used to pore over the classified football results. And you would see that Rochdale had beaten Southport and there was 1,200 there. And I was fascinated. And places like Barrow, where the hell was Barrow? Where's Workington? So, from an early age, again, it's all part of the fascination of football for me. And it just sort of went on from that. I never made any conscious effort to memorise the stats. Just some stats just stick in your head, you know, like the Chelsea one I've just reeled off. You know, I can't reel off 92 record attendances, can't do that. So I guess that it was just, again, it was just all part of the wonderment of football at an early age, really.
And I'm not trying to age you, but I imagine there was very little technology back then to put your stats and information into.
No, not at all.
So is that the cutting out would, sort of newspaper art?
Yeah, scrapbooks. I've got a huge collection of scrapbooks. And that's one thing I would say here. My predecessor, Dave Batters, who obviously did all the wonderful York City books, the two books, you really appreciate what Dave and his, you know, his friends did back in the day, because they didn't have the internet. They didn't have any of the all the massive sources of information. They probably had the Rothmans and some notes from Wilf Meek and Malcolm Huntington. So I'm just astonished what they were able to achieve and the accuracy by which they achieved it in that time, because now it's far, far easier to, you know, compared with then, to do any research.
Yeah, and you've got some fantastic audio of John Champion covering York City in the 1980s, which I used as part of the interview I did with him. Sort of talk me through how you recorded these sort of bits from the radio then. And do you have them on all sort of cassettes and stuff like that?
Radio York, I think, started about 83. And they started off at a really good season, because 83, 84 was obviously the 101 points year. And I was very, very lucky. I just started work then, and I'd already decided I wanted to do a full season of games. So that was my big thing in that first year of work, was to use holidays up and go to the games. When there was anything on post-match, I would record the programme. I think there was probably one on at 6 o'clock on an evening. So I would just put a cassette in and leave it running. And then I just had to remember at 7:15 to go in and turn the cassette over, because there were C90s or C60s or whatever. I did that for a year or so, you know, just when it got to the big games like Arsenal and Liverpool, I would do the same thing. It's quite weird. I was talking to a guy called John Rawnsley. Turned out I wasn't the only person doing that, because he also, it transpires as an archive of such things. And we've shared some of them with yourself and with John Champion and a few other people over the years. And it's quite touching how a lot of these people who are actually doing that commentary, you might be the same, Dan, with the stuff you do. It must be quite weird to hear your earlier recordings from donkey's years back, which you think have long since been lost. So it's been really nice to do stuff like that and to be able to help people out with memories like that, really.
Yeah, and the book mentions that you've probably seen York City around 1,900 times. I mean, you haven't put that figure out of thin air, have you? So do you write down which games you've been to? Have you got an exact record?
I will confess to making a note of the games, and I just put a little mark or a little tick or something next to them. So I have a rough idea of what I've been to. It's quite interesting, because me and my mate Terry were working out how many grounds we'd seen City on. And there was a game at Billingham about 3 or 4 years ago. I have absolutely no memory of going to it. And he was convinced I'd gone to it. And it turned out it was a reserve game at Billingham, Stinthorne, Billingham Town. I looked on my phone and I'd taken some pictures. And I had no memory at all of going to that game, because it wasn't a first-team game. So I'm not as good as what you might think I am. I am prone to error, as people will testify, I'm sure.
And you mentioned there that, you know, you wanted to get to every game in 83, 84, and I think you did the same in 92, 93 as well, apart from the playoff semi-final at Bury, which...
Yeah. Well, the playoff semi-final at Bury, I had a good reason, Dan. I was on my honeymoon. So my lovely wife Anne and I, we set the wedding date in November time, I think it was. And we wanted a May wedding, and May the 1st just looked like a great time to get married. And as it turned out, we didn't have a game that day anyway, because for one reason or another. But that wasn't the reason I stressed that. But the ironic thing was obviously City ended up in the playoffs that year. But the first game was at Bury, and that was the last day of our honeymoon. We'd gone to Cyprus, and we were coming back on a flight at something like 2:30 on the afternoon of the game. The last day on holiday is a bit confined to pool. I did have a bit of a sneaky look before we went to see if we could get back any sooner, but it just wasn't possible. I think Terry had a mobile phone through his work, and it was one of the first mobile phones. And I'm pretty sure that I rang Terry straight after the game. At an expensive cost back in the day, I recall, just to find out what the score was. Again, you had no mobile phones to follow up game like you do now. I do find it weird now how you can be sunning yourself in Lanzarote and watching York City on your stream. I just find it quite astonishing that you can do that when you go back to what you couldn't do.
Yeah, I suppose there's one way that you'll always remember your wedding anniversary and stuff,
That's
given the
right.
year of 93 of York City getting promoted.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't forget that for lots of reasons, Dan. I wouldn't dare.
So obviously,
Is there a man who would ever dare forget his wedding anniversary? I would hope not.
so 83, 84, 92, 93, home and away, most kind of games there. Were they the sort of like halcyon days for you, kind of supporting them? And who would your all-time sort of favourite player be? Would they come from those sort of eras?
Yeah, it's interesting because the 83-84 one was just a bit of an ambition. The 92-93 one was just how it evolved because of the season. And obviously, it's a lot easier to go to the games, the dedication to go to the games when they're doing well. So I was very, very lucky to pick those seasons or those seasons would evolve. In terms of my favourite 11, that's a really good question. For me, they were the halcyon days for sure for York City. You would go to games, home or away, and you would have this, I wouldn't call it arrogance, but you'd have this expectation that A, you were going to be entertained and B, you were going to win. And it's a quite surreal feeling for a York City fan because that's not an experience that most of us will ever profess to have very regularly. The only time I think I could think of where we matched that was probably last year. The football last year was terrific, really, for what we'd seen in previous years. I've made a note of my favourite team, but we can cover that off whenever you want, really. But if you ask me again next week, Dan, it'll change again.
Let's finish with that at the end, shall we? I mean, Michael Miles came in to do a talk to some students at the school I work at, and he made a great comment that really stuck with me about going to away games. He said you could have a 10-hour round trip. The football's only 90 minutes of those 10 hours. And I think he was sort of meaning that it's the stories and the journeys that you do with the others that you kind of often remember more. So you've had so many memorable away trips, and particularly with the likes of Terry Espinosa, you mentioned before. So what sort of sticks out for you in terms of sort of memories of going away?
Quirky things are the things that really bear out for me. We played Barnet away in 92, 93, the quite famous game that Ian Blackstone mentioned on your podcast recently. And when we were getting near Barnet, there was a roundabout, and we went round this roundabout twice because we didn't quite know where we were going. So we were making a load of fun about this roundabout, and of course we won 5-1. So when we went there again the following season and won 3-1, we had to go around this roundabout twice again. And we had all sorts of weird things. It's a lot of them were to do with journeys in cars. We went to Aldershot, and I also remember the driver steaming because we went to fill the car up, and it was one of these early inceptions of supermarkets in garages. And Terry was wanting to pay for his petrol. It took him about 20 minutes because he was stood behind a couple of people who had done the weekly shop. But it's all sorts of weird stuff like that.
I kind of vaguely remember you talking about an away trip to Bournemouth,
Oh, the
my away trip
Bournemouth, yeah,
to
the
the way you
Bournemouth
got
game
called
was,
off with
yeah,
it.
it was another car thing, actually. That was quite funny. So 2002, 2003, I think. And we had a really, really bad journey. At one point, we were stuck on some single carriageway roads behind like a steam engine rally. And there was these guys on like big steam rollers and steam engines going up a hill. They were dressed in white, but they had really big, long, flowing beards. They looked like they'd just come from a ZZ Top convention. And that lost us a load of time. So we had this last hour to get to the game. And somehow we got there at 10 to 3. Terry went to park the car and said, I'll go and get the tickets. And we parked this car in a bit of waste ground. And I went straight to the window to get the tickets and got tickets straight away. But there was really big queues for the home end tickets. So when Terry came, I said, look at the queue. Look at the queue here. We're not going to get in. And so he wasn't very impressed, impressed with that until he realised we've got to get in very easily. And then we got back to the car and it had a ticket on it, stuff like that. But the ZZ Top thing, the traction engine rally, we just topped it off, really. Everyone who goes to a game will remember games where you have a nightmare getting there and you end up getting in by the seat of your pants, and often you get beat. And sure enough, we got beat 1-0. So that probably capped the day, really.
Yeah, it sounds very, very York City if it would lose 1-0. And I remember kind of vividly how much you and Terry talked about your kind of hatred for Darlington. So most York fans, it would be Scarborough, but you two, it was very much about Darlington. So what is it about Darlington that you two don't like?
If you live in Norfolk County, you know, North Yorkshire's a big county, of course, you're probably nearer Middlesbrough and Darlington than you are York, really. But Darlington was always the away game. You know, from Thirst, you could jump on the train and be at Darlington in 20 minutes. And Terry lived in Northallerton, I think, and he certainly did. And he was the same. And we just have this irrational hatred of him. You know, my best favourite game at Bilton Crescent, I think, you know, all the time, you know, forget the Liverpool game and the Arsenal game and the Bury playoff game. No, best game was us being at Darlington 7-0, 85-86. It was fantastic. We worked at County Hall at Northallerton at the time, and there was a guy in one of the teams who was a Darlington fan. And he got pelters on Monday morning, absolute pelters. But there was tins of Seven Up on his desk when he came in and all sorts of stuff. It was great. But yeah, Tony Cannon obviously knew how important that game was to people at North Cammy, because they got actually, you know, well done, TC, if you get to listen to this. I don't think City have a natural rival, do they? People talk about Hull City and Doncaster and Leeds. But, you know, in terms of playing clubs week in, you know, season in, season out, Darlington, we played them probably as many times as we've played most clubs, I think.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why they haven't been a natural rival to us, really.
I feel like Luton was almost the biggest rival I've seen us have that one season, where we did seem to play them quite a lot because we drew them in the trophy and stuff. And I always sort of think, is there sort of Paul Bowers and these sort of people at other clubs? I mean, you know, you got yourself, York City South's incredible, lots of good ones on X and Y Front as well, sort of digs up the history every day, doesn't he, with his photos and everything.
Oh, it's fantastic. What Michael does is fantastic, yeah.
And the sort of oracle, really, was the late, great Dave Batters, who you mentioned earlier, who's kind of my inspiration with York Hospital Radio. So how often did you and Dave cross paths, and how did your sort of historian role come about, and sort of, was it quite... It must have felt quite a big thing to fill sort of Dave Batters' shoes, really.
Oh, yeah, it was a privilege. Dave was a lovely guy. I went down to his house a couple of times over the years for different, you know, different things, York City-wise. And I would always see him in the car park before a game. And he was always unfailingly cheerful and optimistic about how we would do. And we would discuss, you know, just a couple of minutes, discuss the team. He'd have the team sheet, would you, you know, cheerily discuss the team and the subs and what have you, and the prospects. But he was a real inspiration for the stuff we did. You know, everything that we all do nowadays, you know, York City South, Chris Forth and Andy Naylor do a lot of fantastic stuff on there, on the York City site website. It's absolutely wonderful, the amount of data that's on there. I look at that all the time. But ultimately, it's really the foundation that Dave Batters put in, that's enabled all that to happen. So I'm really conscious, I was really proud and privileged and honoured to follow in Dave's footsteps when I was asked to be a historian in 2020. But they're really big boots to fill, and I could never have filled it without the stuff that Dave had done before that. It couldn't have happened. Yeah. As I said, he was such a lovely guy as well.
Yeah, he was, absolutely. And one thing that always struck me about Dave was that it wasn't just York City. Kind of, he knew loads and loads of stuff about cricket as well. And is that the same with you? It was yours sort of purely York City, or is there other sports or music?
It was really York City and football. But, you know, I'm a fan of cricket, big fan of cricket, really. And the cricket stats are a different level from football, I think. The cricket stats just blow me away how good they are, because there's so many facets. You know, somebody come out with a stat yesterday, it wasn't about Ben Stokes, who'd just taken 5 wickets against India, and it was the longest gap in terms of matches between 5 wicket hauls in Test cricket. I don't want to go down that line, though, Dan, because that's a whole new avenue of pain, really.
Yeah, I'm sure. One of the roles of being a historian is often to contribute to the match day programme. I know you used to love a programme, and I used to love a programme, but I've kind of found that I've waned with my kind of passion for it over the last sort of 10, 15 years because of the kind of rise of the internet and all the information you can get elsewhere. So it is kind of a dying breed, but are you still someone who shares that the passion still burns bright? You still get a programme every game you go to?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think programmes are really, really important. And I would say that, wouldn't I? I'm a bit of a programme collector obsessive, and I'm the first one. You know, I'll enter the confessional box and admit to that. The thing that people have to appreciate with programmes is, whilst everything's gone digital, programmes are a real snapshot of a point in time in any event, just as newspapers are, just as periodicals are. So it's really important that they survive in that format, in my opinion. I would always defend the place of a football program amongst all the other media mix that you've got nowadays. In terms of York City, I do the history spot on the program. I always try and make that interesting, and I always try and work that into modern events as well, because as much as we like to think things like that have never happened before, quite often they have. But you haven't seen everything because you haven't seen the future, is what I always say to people. But generally speaking, you always get the same trends in football that evolve over the years. And I always try and make it different. I think the way programmes will survive is by having independent articles from people who are connected with a club, who care for the club. And I think that's the way forward. A lot of programmes now are too big, Dan. You know, they're 100 pages and they're full of bland articles or adverts even. And I think you've got to make the content unique enough, like a USP, for people to buy them.
I feel like the home program is well worth a read. It's more like when I'm going to away grounds and I pick it up and I sort of think, you know, I have a flick through it and think I'm not really sure what I've bought it for, and that's why I don't tend to seek them out now. I think if they're there, I might pick one up, but I don't go out of my way, is what I'm saying.
Clubs are obliged to produce a programme, and I think that shows sometimes where clubs are going through the motions in producing them because they have an obligation to do so.
And let's move on to the book, Boom Crescent, A Second Home, Part Three, your third in the trilogy. Now, you mentioned at the start that you never it was never your intention to write a book, and you've ended up writing three.
No.
So when did the light bulb sort of come on, and you sort of think, no, I need to make this into a book or?
Yeah, the light bulb. Well, I'd have switched the light off if I'd realised it was going to take me 10 years down, that's for sure. I had a second bulb out. So when it happened was, obviously, City had this, as the book explains, had this quite difficult, fractured path from Bootham Crescent to the community stadium, and all the roots of that are back in the 2000s with Bootham Crescent Holdings creation. But I approached the club in 2015 through the media team back in the day, and I said to them, look, club's due to leave Bootham Crescent. I'll do a series of articles for the programme, and I'll try and make them about City's time at Bootham Crescent, and I'll do them up front, and then you can pop them in as a series, you know, maybe the last season at Bootham Crescent, you can include them every game. And I can remember researching one programme, one article, when I was at York Library in September 2015, while City were playing at Luton, oddly enough. You mentioned Luton earlier. But that was 10 years ago, actually, when I think about how long I've been looking at it. And it so morphed. I found stuff out that Dave hadn't covered, or, you know, Dave's book hadn't covered. And that's not to say Dave didn't know about it, but it wasn't out there for anybody to read. And as I dug deeper and deeper, there was more and more stuff, and I was just hooked then. I was like a guy in a gold mine with my hammer and chisel and just finding loads of stuff. And that's how it evolved. And then very quickly I realised there was too much stuff to start doing articles. It almost needed its own little book. And then as you start looking into the book, you think, well, actually, I can't cover that without covering that, and I can't cover that. So it suddenly it becomes a rabbit warren of little threads that you want to cover. And that's how the book's evolved. And the early stuff, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, that I covered in book one were just absolutely fascinating. Obviously, it was a different world back then. You know, we think of what's changed in our lifetime, but you think of what changed in the 20s to the 1960s, again, was probably just as vast. And I found that incredibly fascinating, how City had moved to Bootham Crescent and from Fulford Gate, and how the fans had built the stand and all that type of stuff. And there was some huge archives I sort of stumbled over from Parish of St Saviour's, and that was all at York Library, and there was loads of old letters just saying that City hadn't paid the rent, the £90 a year rent and things like that, and it was just wonderful. So that's how it sort of evolved. And then once you've written book one, you start on book two. Book two had to be split into book two and three. So, yeah, I can see how it's evolved. I'm glad it's done. But I've really, really enjoyed doing it. Really enjoyed doing it. I hope that comes across when people read them.
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, you clearly love Bootham Crescent, and you know, and I can tell that sort of reading the books as I have. And I just wondered how you felt about the move personally to the LNER, because you know there was a lot of us love Bootham Crescent and love the nostalgia of it and everything. But then Some people recognise that we did need to move. Some people maybe fought against it. Even someone like Michael Miles, like I mentioned earlier, I think he fought against it initially and then now has sort of found his place in the South Stand. So where do you sit on the kind of move? How do you feel about the LNER?
Well, what I would say is nostalgia never goes out of fashion and everybody will always hat back on to good times. And I'm no different from that. I'm exactly the same. I've spent a lot of time at Booth and Crescent, which is why the book was called The Second Home, because to a certain extent, that's where I was every other Saturday for 9 months of the year. But I think for me, it was probably the circumstances under which City moved. It was horrendous and they were pushed into it and they were left with an almost impossible situation because of BCH being created. So I think the problem I had with the move overall wasn't so much the need to move, it was the circumstances on which City had to do. And again, I think that comes across in the book. What I felt nowadays, if you look at the crowds we're getting at the LNER now, when you compare them with the crowds we're getting at Booth and Crescent, you cannot in any way, shape or form argue that the move in terms of attracting a new supporter base and involving the communities has been a real benefit to the club compared with staying at Booth and Crescent. One of the problems at Booth and Crescent was attracting a new fan base and the demographic of fans, and I think that's significantly changed in the last 4 years, to be honest, and that would never have happened at Booth and Crescent. And of course, the club had looked at all sorts of different options for Booth and Crescent and redeveloping Booth and Crescent in the 90s, and none of them proved to be feasible because the area was so landlocked with, you know, buildings around it. So as much as I didn't want to move, I absolutely understood the decisions as to why City had to move. But there's this regret, isn't there, about how we had to move, the circumstances under which it became something we had to do rather than it being a choice. COVID robbed a lot of people of lots of things, but in terms of York City, it robbed York City fans on being able to have a proper send-off for the ground, and I think that's a really sad thing. But
and you've obviously got so much knowledge about the club, and you would have already had so much knowledge about Booth and Crescent, having been there so many times over your life. But was there anything when you sort of started writing the books that surprised you, or even maybe you discovered some of it made you feel quite emotional?
I think most fans will know that City's record attendance was 28,000. 1-2-3 against Huddersfield, 1938 FA Cup. I can remember being in Booth and Crescent, I think when there was 10, 11, 12,000 people there tops. You imagine having twice as many people and then some at Booth and Crescent. And you've seen these famous pictures from the 30s where fans are on the touchlines. You know, people are taking corners or whatever, or taking throw-ins or... And there's people on the touchlines, encroaching the touchlines, the other side of the rails. When you see it the way the club and football generally treated supporters... Back in the day, they just used to cram them in. The Shipton Street end, which wasn't the preferred end back in the 30s, that just got banked up and banked up with railway sleepers and ashes, it was called. That's how they got people in. They just banked it up higher and higher and higher. And that's the astonishing thing for me, is what football fans put up with from their clubs to see a game back in the 1920s and 30s. The conditions people watch games in, there's stories about people, frankly, urinating from the top of the banking at the Shipton Street end and it running down. The club was taken to court by the council for poor sanitation in the 1930s. So that's what amazes me, I think, about the club and the ground, the way it evolved. And the other thing is how much supporters were involved in actually doing the work. I think famously City fans did an awful lot of work in lifting and shifting stuff from Fulford Gate to Booth and Crescent.
There's lots of bits in this third book that's just come out that, you know, I've been lucky enough to get my copy yesterday and sort of looking through it last night. It was fascinating. Several bits that sort of surprised me or I'd forgotten about. Like, can you talk about sort of history in football repeating itself? Like, Leeds United playing their reserve fixtures at Booth and Crescent, which I'd completely forgotten about. And you sort of think about how the under-23s were playing at the LNER and ruining the pitch and stuff like that. That was kind of happening back then as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Leeds played quite a few games, I think, in the late 1990s, 2000s at Booth and Crescent. The thing that's really ironic is City's pitch got so bad, Leeds moved, didn't they? They actually moved away and they went to play at a rugby league venue for the reserves because they thought the rugby league pitch was safer than City's pitch. Again, history just repeats itself, yeah.
And another one as well, I didn't even know this, but there was a picture you had of John Batchelor basically getting wiped out in a pre-season friendly. He
was
brought himself on as a sub against Bracknell Town. I'd no recollection of that whatsoever.
I didn't like Don Batchelor. I'm hoping that hasn't come across too much in the books. I've tried to be very even-handed and not put personal viewpoints across, but I really hated everything he tried to do. You know, he tried to make the club funky and chic and and he had the checkered flag stuff. So when he decided he would name himself as a sub against Bracknell Town and he would come on for the last 5 minutes because it was a bit fun and a bit, you know, cheeky, I detested it. Absolutely. I was incandescent with rage. I think I remember standing up and, let's just say I wasn't impressed that he'd come on. And when this guy clattered him, it was just wonderful. It was a wonderful moment. And when I found that cutting and that picture of him being clattered, yeah, I thought, that's going in. That's going in the book. But yeah, the bachelor thing, there were so many scattergun things going on at that time. I felt he just put York City into disrepute. The thing about the soccer club thing as well, wanting to call it soccer club because he felt it would crack America. And Manchester United had paired up with New York Yankees to try and crack America and they couldn't do it. So why did we think we could do it, you know? Anyway, that's all in the past now.
Yeah, and you say it's in the past, but I mean, obviously that... The third book covers, and it basically covers the whole time I support York. I started going to York City in 1992, and the book covers up to the present day. So for me, out of the three books, it's the one that I can relate to the most because I remember these things. But like I say, I forgot a lot of these sort of details. So even like the drawings that you've got in the book about the potential stadium at Clifton Moor that was wrote out, so sort of like I think that was where the Roco site is now.
That's right, yeah, where
17,500 capacity as well, which again I'd completely forgotten that that was even a thing that they were trying to do.
Let's go back to Darlington again, Dan, shall we? The Reynolds Arena at Darlington,
yes,
you know, built by George Reynolds, who had a bit of a checkered past. I think it was called the Stadium of Loot rather than the Stadium of Light, let's put it like that. And when City were looking at building this stadium, this at Roco, and you saw the artist's impression of it. It just smacked of Reynolds Arena at Darlington in terms of why would you build something of that size in a town of that size? You know, the Darlington one was just ridiculous. And the York City one was just far too big for the club at that time. And it was just the wrong thing at the wrong time in the wrong place, yeah? So, but yeah, things like that, I felt it was sort of my era and lots of people's era. And when you're writing about things that are happening, contemporary things, very, very hard to write it. Very, very hard. It's a lot easier in some respect writing about things in the past because you're really conscious not to misrepresent things. You're really conscious not to upset people because I don't want to upset people. I just want to put, you know, out there what I believe to be facts, you know. So I've actually found this book the hardest of the three books to write because of the fact that I've lived through it, really. So it's interesting how you found it interesting because of that, and I found it most challenging because of that.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I mean, I think when I'm interviewing players that I've not seen, I'm always conscious to get things right in terms of their career because obviously I didn't see them play. But other things in the book as well, like I love the pictures and you know, like even one like, the headline York City signed Bent, which obviously at the time,
oh, that was cracking. Yeah, that was Bent really good.
And obviously it was just a picture of I think a sign that had got blown in the wind or something.
Yeah,
like
it was
that.
A club sign. It was a sign into the car above the car park had been blown off in the gales. That's right. Yeah. What I would say, Danny, is the one thing I've really tried to do in the books, in all three books, is I've tried to put band culture into it as well because I don't think that's been covered really previously. And why would it be? There's never really been the vehicle to do that. So these books have also tried to talk about the fanzines and the fan culture and all that type of thing as well. And of course, some of them, I've tried to make it a little bit more offbeat and I've tried to set it up where you can dip in and out of it as well. So I'm glad you found that signed one because I thought that was fantastic. Imagine Darren Bent in his pomp playing for York City. That would have been good, wouldn't it?
You definitely would have got on the team, that's for certain. And even ones like, and I think I got this right, but the sort of official date of when York City was founded.
Oh, don't go there. Oh, Dan, don't go there. That gave me so much pain, so many sleepless nights, honestly. So what happened is I was asked to help out with the centenary stuff in 2022, which was a real privilege to do. And I'd done a lot of the work, obviously the back work. But there's this thing set up in stone that the club had been formed on the 6th of May, because on the 6th of May 1922, that was, although there was a meeting on the 31st of March 1922 to see whether there was enough of a groundswell of opinion to form a York City FC. It wasn't until the 6th of May where they got enough people and enough of a committee to say, right, we're definitely going to go and do this. This is going to happen. So the 6th of May was the first time I saw that date was in an article written by Wilf Meek in about 1928, 1929. So, and from that time on, that date has propagated itself as being the 6th of May is when York City formed. Almost every book you'll find about York City 6th of May 1922. Why would I ever doubt it? And then a day before the launch, the 6th of May at York City, the day before the centenary stuff all kicked off, found this news cutting just completely by chance. And the news cutting was dated the 6th of May, and it referred to a meeting that had taken place on the night before, which was the 5th of May, which was a meeting at which they decided to form the club. Therefore, the centenary date was wrong. It was wrong by a day. I was absolutely... It was one of these things you couldn't unsee in life that you wish you'd never seen, but you had. And then, what do I do with this information? And as a historian, you want stuff to be right, don't you? That's one of the things you'd like to... You think it's a bit of a starting point. I was mortified. So I sort of kept it under me. I told a couple of people just so I could clear my own mind of, you know, to share the burden. You know what they say, a trouble shared is a trouble halved. So that I just thought I would just finally rid that off, you know, get that off my conscience and put it out there and hide it in a book and hope nobody finds it. But clearly you have done.
Yeah, sorry about that. In the previous book you did, I remember I loved reading the York City Supporters Club's five principles, which fans were encouraged to follow when watching matches. And I wondered whether you could remember the five.
No, it was something to do with encourage fair play by both sides. Now, that's one that could probably do with making a comeback, I think.
Yes.
Yes, some very partisan supporters, don't we?
I'll read them out to you. So, yeah, number one was see both sides. Two, discourage foul play and barracking. Three, right, protect the reputation of the game on the terraces. Four, encourage all referees. And five, stand by the club in bad weather.
Yeah, well, I can claim at least two of those, but not all of them, I think. I'll certainly stand by the club in bad weather. And I'll also actually sort of half defend referees because I think they have an absolutely impossible job. But I can't claim necessarily to be fully compliant with the other three at all times. I'm just a fan, Dan. I'm just a fan like everybody else is, you know.
And players have obviously got very understanding partners behind them when they're moving from club to club. And
oh, yeah, I don't know how they do it. Yeah,
of the country. That must be the same for you. Your poor wife, while you've been slaving over this trilogy of books, what she must be very kind of understanding and give you a lot of space to do it.
No, Anne's wonderful. She's always been very, very supportive, as indeed as all my family. Honestly, they've been fantastic. But Anne's quite happy to watch all this nonsense on Netflix in 12 weekly parts and stuff like that. So it gives me a bit of a get out. And there's sort of a cut off where we'll watch stuff together and what have you. So it's fine. It's fine, Dan.
She's all right. So, yeah, let's finish off with your all-time 11 then. You said it might change tomorrow, but what would it be today?
What would it be today? Well, I've made a note here, and it's really hard, isn't it? Because you're comparing players across different eras. So I've decided not to do that, Dan. I've decided to go to something a bit simpler. And I'm going to say what my favourite players have been since 1974, since I started watching. And these players are all players who played regularly. Because I could have shoehorned Phil Burrows in at left-back, because everybody tells me you have to have Phil Burrows in your team at left-back. And I did see him play once in that very, very first game I went to in 1974, but I can't remember a thing about it. So for all Phil Burrows devotees out there, I'd love to include him, but I can't remember him playing. I've used a bit of artistic freedom as well. I'm assuming some of my players are very two-footed, especially the fullbacks, but we'll come to that. So I think this team is going to be lots of creativity, lots of goals and hard as nails. So I'll go with it now. Dean Carley in goal. I would have Derek Codd, John McPhail, Ray Warburton and Joe Felix, which might be a surprise, in the back four. I'd have Tony Canham, Ian Holmes, Nigel Pepper and John McCarthy as midfield. And there's only two players you can have up front, Dan, and that's Walwyn and Byrne. Yeah. And I would allow myself the luxury of a subs bench as well, Dan, you know, which has got a bit of wriggle room. I would have Graham Crawford on the bench for us as well. Chris Toppin, Andy McMillan, Matty Blair, Gordon Staniforth and Paul Barnes. So you've got plenty of firepower on the bench and you've got, you know, a little bit of height there. Really good, fantastic goalkeeper and Andy Mack. So,
yeah. 11. I'm presuming that's 4-4-2 based on...
Yeah, 4-4-2, I think, is what I put down there. But, you know, two wingers to provide some service. Hard as nails on Nigel Pepper, hard as nails. Joe Felix, fantastic. Loves a tackle, and he's brilliant. Ray Warburton, I thought, was a great centre-half. Absolutely fantastic alongside McPhail. Load of clubmen, load of stalwarts. Load of goals. So, yeah, I will put that forward as my favourite 11. I'm not saying it's the best 11, but it's my favourite 11.
It's a good lineup. And, you know, the book, let's finish off with the book as final sort of question, really. So it's as up to date as it could be. I mean, I know this is a picture of the Oldham playoff game, which is the last sort of competitive fixture, you know, as is all the details of every kind of fixture at the LNER Stadium, fixtures, statistics. You've even got things about like halftime entertainment, which even references the Titan Bin Challenge. So it's as up to date for York City fans as it possibly could be. So how do people get their hands on it? I mean, I've been, you know, I bought the subscription, so I've got my copy. How do other people get their kind of copies if they want one?
Two definite ways at the moment, and third one hopefully coming up. Yeah, sort of the easiest way to get a copy of this is to go to www.yorkbookshop.com, all one word, yorkbookshop.com. If you go on that, that's a website which is for the company who published it for me. And if it's not on the front page, just type it in at the address bar, at the search bar. Just put Bills and Crescent and the book will come up. You could email me directly at minsterman@sky.com. People would love that email address, I'm sure. Minsterman@sky.com. And all being well, the club shop will be stocking the book with a little bit of luck. That would probably be sometime in August. So hopefully by the time this podcast goes out, Dan, the shop will be stocking the book. It costs £35. It's 370 pages. It covers 1993 to 2025.
So, Paul, thank you for giving up your time this morning. It's been a great to kind of talk to you about all things York City. Wish you every success with the book and, you know, enjoy the many plaudits that are going to come your way over the next few months, I think, of people buying it and reading it. And like you say, you can't, you mentioned there, you have to kind of dip in and out of it. You definitely do. It's a massive book. It's going to take a long time for me to get through it, but, you know, it's going to be a pleasure when I do.
Yeah, Dan, listen, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate having a natter with you. I'm really grateful that I've been on this podcast. I feel it's a bucket list tick off this one, Dan. And listen, just want to thank everybody as well for supporting the book and everybody. So many people, they're all mentioned in the back. So I don't want to say anything because I dare miss somebody off who've helped me along the way in the last 10 years to get three books out, because without that help, it wouldn't have been anything like the book you have before you or you'll have before you. So thanks to everyone who's helped me as well. Appreciate it.